Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. And well, we're hoping this evening we're going to have Pastor David Whitney with us, so that we're not going to have a monologue. And I see that red lights are on up here on the board, which means that Pastor David Whitney is with us. And, of course, we're going to be talking about the Constitution. Now, people say, oh, the Constitution, well, let me tell you that the only barrier we have between us and the establishment of a feudal dictatorship is the Constitution of the United States, because this is the very foundation upon which our freedom rests. Now, there are people who want to have a dictatorship. There are people who believe that they should rule. There are people who believe in a feudalistic system with everybody being serfs. But the one thing that stands in the way is that they don't want to be accused of breaking the law now. They get their people on the Supreme Court to undermine our Constitution. They have their people in the media to demonize those of us who talk about the Constitution. They even have their people in the FBI who tell you that you can tell a terrorist because he talks about the Constitution. And if you don't believe that, why, you go up on our website at RadioLiberty.com, where we actually have a copy of a directive that was put out by the Phoenix Terrorist Task Force, and there they talk about how you can tell a terrorist, and, well, you can tell a terrorist because he talks about the Constitution. Now, this was back in 1969 when they knew all about Islamic terrorism, but, of course, they were trying to focus the attention of the American people on the danger of those of us who believe in our freedom, who believe in the Constitution rather than the Islamic terrorism. And the people there in Phoenix knew, and they were watching the Islamic terrorists. In fact, the whole Islamic terrorist movement was thoroughly infiltrated by our own government and our agencies, just as we'd infiltrated the communist movement and the mafia movement and the militia movement. And the, I mean, they were all infiltrated, and so were the Islamic terrorists, but they were focusing our attention on people who believe in the Constitution. Well, with that as a background, David, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. It's always a pleasure to be on your show and to remind all the listeners that the price of liberty, that is, if we're going to retain the liberty that our founders bequeathed to us, the price is eternal vigilance. And it starts with understanding, as you mentioned already, understanding the foundational documents of our land. If Americans don't understand the law, then, as you said, those in the Supreme Court, those in the legislature, those in the White House can get away with breaking that law, and nobody will hold them accountable. And so tonight we want to talk about what took place in the Constitutional Convention. What were they concerned about? What was their understanding, their underpinning? I believe last month we talked a bit about the Articles of Confederation and mentioned some of the problems that were actually caused by weaknesses in that document, that the Constitution was designed to eliminate those problems. If you go back to that era of time, there was a terrible combination of inflation and recession, in part because they had said that paper money, fiat money, was permissible. And so what happens whenever you have fiat money? You've got runaway inflation. Congress was unable to raise money, only to send requests to the states for raising money, and that didn't work very well. And then there was domestic disturbances like Shays' Rebellion and so on. And then the states began treating each other as foreign nations, which created all kinds of problems, including border disputes among the states and border problems with Canadian English as well as the Spanish in the West. And so there were several attempts on the part of Hamilton and others to urge for a stronger government. It really got nowhere.
Hold on thought there for just a moment, sure. David, and we're going to be coming back in just a moment. We're talking about really what was going on, the Constitutional Convention there in Philadelphia back in 1787. All right, David, and our guest, of course, is Pastor David Whitney. We're talking about what happened to the Constitutional Convention, and fortunately, the record was carefully kept by James Madison of all the various ideas that come out. And, of course, you have Alexander Hamilton, and he wants a monarchy. He wants an all-powerful government like they had in England, and of course, he was a little upset when this was not what the American people wanted and what the representatives of the American people wanted. They wanted something different than they had in England. They wanted a country where the power of the government was limited, where there was no ruler, and where the people could be free. So pick up the story, David.
And so you need to remember that each of the states had a very strong central government of their own. Each state constitution had been ratified, and each state, they were functioning, basically as separate nations almost. And so the movement began to call for a true convention when George Washington wrote a letter to the 13 states urging them to a constitutional convention, and this was taken up by Congress, which also called for it. And on 14th of May in 1787, the first few delegates, only from two states actually, arrived, and during those days, from May 14th to May 25th, James Madison and others from Virginia wrote down their agenda, and that's what is known as the Virginia Resolves, which actually became the basic agenda for the Constitution. And as the delegates began to gather, they really began meeting formally and officially on the 25th, and they elected a president, that is, one who would moderate over the discussion and the debate, and that was George Washington. 55 delegates came from 12 states. Actually, Rhode Island never did send any delegates and didn't participate and was ultimately the last state to ratify the Constitution. But when you look at the composition of those who attended, the delegates were very educated and experienced and intelligent men. 31 of them were attorneys. We won't hold that against them. There were 19 military veterans and 28 former congressmen. There were two college presidents, three college professors, several doctors and scientists. And these men were highly intelligent. They were the cream of the crop of that day.
You know, I think one of the most important things was, David, they understood history. They understood what had happened in ancient Greece. They understood what had happened in ancient Rome. They knew what was wrong with democracy. They understood the strengths of these concepts of a republic. And they knew that you could never trust government with power. And because they were Christians, they really believed that men were basically corrupt. And I think one of them said, you know, if men were angels, we wouldn't need government.
Right. That was Madison. And they understood that all men have a sinful nature, including the rulers that you may elect to a position of power. And so,
hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment with Pastor Whitney. All right. Pastor Whitney is just telling us what happened there in May of 1787 when the initial people arrived. Certainly there was James Madison. There were only half a dozen. Then there were when they were supposed to start their consideration. And Madison and the others from Virginia had written something called the Virginia Resolution, which then became the framework for the Constitutional Convention. So pick up the story, David.
Well, we need to remember that the delegates had a very solid agreement on what you almost would call a theology of government, that is, what you believe about government. They agreed that the laws of nature and nature's God were absolute. And by those two phrases, we need to remember that they meant the first. The laws of nature refers to human conscience upon which God has written his law on the heart of every human being, as Romans 2 says. And the laws of nature's God, that second phrase, directly refers to the Bible, God's revealed law. These were the absolute laws that they were seeking to follow. Now, there's a theory afoot among many historians today. As a matter of fact, just a month and a half ago, I debated a historian here in Maryland, and he claims that there was this great change in thinking between the time of the Declaration and the time of the Constitution, and these people in the Constitution were establishing a secular republic and all this garbage. It's a lie. They believed the same as those who signed the Declaration of Independence. The laws of nature and the laws of nature's God, these are the absolute law underlying everything that they were doing. So they were seeking to build it upon God's revealed truth, as we said. For one instance, one example is they believed all men are sinners, and therefore they had to structure government with checks and balances so that the sin nature of the executive will be balanced off against the sin nature of the legislature and the sin nature of those in the judiciary. I understood if you design it that way, then you cancel out the negative effects that the sin nature will have in terms of those in places of power. Furthermore, they believe that God has given to human beings, not just Americans, but all human beings, unalienable rights. That is, rights that cannot be taken away from you. They're given to you by God, such as life and liberty and property. These are absolutes that they believe. And they understood that government also is established by a covenant. That is, it's we the people entering into a covenant with the civil government that we created. The civil government is our servant, not our master. And again, this is a belief and an understanding that has been lost in our day, where most people now say, you know, whatever the government says is right because it's the government and it's our master instead of our slave or our servant. And they understood that to be safe and to actually have liberty that God has given to us as human beings, you only can give government limited power, and that power has to be very carefully enumerated and delegated to the government by the people. In other words, the people are the sovereigns in this system. There's no king, but the people are sovereign, and they delegate powers that they have by rights given to them by God. They delegate these powers to the civil government they are creating by covenant. And covenant, again, is a very biblical concept. God formed covenants with his people Israel, and Jesus formed a covenant with his people the church. So there's a sense that this is a spiritual and religious act to form a covenant, which is, by the way, why they require in the Constitution that every federal official, and as a matter of fact, every state official, take an oath to uphold the Constitution. Now, an oath is a religious promise, a vow made to Almighty God, and that's an important concept that those who want to say that it was a secular document they were drawing up, the evidence on the face of the document itself is, no, they were drawing up a covenant between we the people and the civil government we created, and we the people and Jesus Christ, who is God. And so they understood that people need order. That is, anarchy is never encouraged in Scripture. People need order and structure. They need government. But the government itself, rulers, they need limits set upon them. And that's exactly what they were seeking to do in creating the Constitution, to establish clear, strict, unchanging limits upon the powers that they were granting, limited powers, delegated and enumerated powers, to the civil government they were establishing. So as we mentioned, that they elected a president, which was Washington, and all discussion and all remarks were to be addressed to the president, such that there would be no cross discussion taking place between the delegates, so in order to do things decently and in order. Furthermore, that each state would only be able to cast one vote. So this delegates from Virginia, say there was 10 delegates from Virginia, they only got to cast one vote. There were maybe 3 delegates from Delaware, they only got to cast one vote as a state. And so it was the majority of that state delegation that would be able to determine how that vote would go. In order to prevent any false rumors from circulating, they kept all the proceedings secret until the last delegate died. And that was in 1836, and it was James Madison who really, as you mentioned earlier, kept the best set of notes and detailed instructions about or discussion about what took place. And they resolved most of the issues that they discussed in that summer leading up into September. Most of the issues were resolved by consensus. That is, they came to an agreement, they figured out a way in which to resolve that. There was only 3 issues that required raw compromises as they dealt with issues, and 2 of those dealt with slavery. One was how to count slaves, and it's interesting because in North and South there's a difference, but actually the difference on both sides is a little hypocritical. The issue was, how do you count slaves for purposes of voting and for purposes of taxing? Of course, the North wanted slaves counted as a full person for taxing purposes, but not in terms of voting, not in terms of, you know, how many representatives the state of Virginia or the state of Georgia would have. They wouldn't want to count the slaves as full persons for that purpose. On the contrary, the South wanted the opposite. They wanted the slaves to count in terms of voting and representation in Congress, but not to be counted in terms of taxes. So you have here a hypocrisy really on both sides in terms of how they were going to deal with the question of how the slaves be counted. Now remember, they were not saying that slaves were any less than a person. We need to remember that voting in that day was restricted only to landholders. In other words, the people who would have a stake in what was decided, because they were the people who were going to be taxed. If you didn't own any land, you had no vote. So it didn't matter whether you were slave or free. If you weren't a landowner, you had no voting in that. And so the compromise they came up with in terms of counting slaves was, for this purpose, a slave was counted as three-fifths. Not that a slave was three-fifths of a person, but that they were counted for purposes of taxation and purposes of voting.
That was representation. They weren't actually going to vote, but they would have representation, right?
Just as many people in these states did not vote because they did not own property. And we can talk about that whole issue as the changes come about in our country now, with more and more people voting. People who don't have a direct interest in how the taxes are going to be gathered are today voting. And oftentimes those people are voting for what? Their own pocketbook. They're welfare recipients, and they're going to vote for more welfare in their pocket. And our founders knew, no, you don't do that. You completely destroy the system if you allow the people to vote out of the public treasury into their own pocket.
And, of course, the other thing was that initially there was no possible way that the federal government would provide anything for anybody. You were not providing for people because they needed it. If people were hungry, there was a problem that was to be taken care of the state and the mm-hmm. local level, never from the federal level.
That's
because,
right.
You know, if the government can provide whatever the people need, the government must be able to take whatever they had, and they must have an all-powerful government, and that is what our founding fathers feared. They feared government because they knew men were basically corrupt, because they believed in the Bible that says that man's heart is basically wicked. So everything they did was to limit the power of government so men could be free. What a unique idea.
Mm-hmm.
And they wonder why they don't teach that today.
And so they reached a compromise on not only the counting of slaves, but then a compromise on when the slave trade would come to an end. And they decided not to allow any legislation that would end slavery for 20 years from the signing of the Constitution. So 1808 was the earliest point in time that any legislation could be put forward to end slavery, because our founders knew that a rapid, radical end of slavery would be disastrous for the slaves. After all, Thomas Jefferson would have loved to have emancipated his slaves, but what are you going to do with these people? You're going to tell them, hey, you're free, go wherever you want. It's like they don't have a job, they don't have a home, they don't have any land. It would be a disaster for the slaves. So they recognize that a slow process of attrition by which emancipation takes place slowly over time was the only fair, just, and good for the slaves way to end slavery. And so they were allowing 20 years for that to take place. Of course, they couldn't foresee what one of my distant relatives wound up doing, inventing the cotton gin, which completely changed the complexion of slavery and made it a profitable institution once again. And so slavery lasted much longer than they could have imagined. The third issue they reached a compromise on was how representation in Congress would take place. Of course, the large states wanted proportionate representation. So Virginia, which at that point in time was the largest and most populous state, would be the most powerful in Congress. And of course, the small states like Delaware said, no, let's have equal representation. We get equal voting power with Virginia. Well, Roger Sherman suggested a compromise, a bicameral Congress, that is a House and a Senate. The House by proportionate representation and the Senate with equal representation. And this was a wise and a good foresight on their part to adopt that compromise and structure our Congress in that way.
And, but I think the other important thing was that certainly the senators, who were, of course, to be proportional of what we representing the states, they were to be elected by the states, were not to be elected by the people. Because they realized that if the people were electing the senators, then, of course, they would be subject to all sorts of pressures from anybody who want to put up the money to buy the senator. Whereas if they represented the states, why, of course, they would not go to the federal government and vote for higher taxes, because the states had to provide the taxes. There was no way to tax the individuals. So, you know, the senator who voted for higher taxes, why, he wasn't going to get reelected by the state.
Mm-hmm.
So he represented the interests of the state, not, of course, direct election of senators. That was one of the worst things that ever happened. We'll talk more about that in just a moment here. Here at Radio Liberty with Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. Well, David, go ahead.
As we mentioned that they started on the 25th of May, actually the convention got off to a very bad start from that point on, and it was late in June, the 28th of June, that Franklin stood up and he began to discuss how, as they had stood in this same room during the War for Independence, they had prayed, and when they prayed, God answered their prayers and delivered them from what looked like sure disaster again and again in the War for Independence, and ultimately brought them victory in that war. And he called for prayer because he said, you know, I've seen that God works in the affairs of men. That is, God's hand is active, and if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground, referring to Scripture, without his oversight, neither can an empire rise without his aid. And so he called for prayer. And actually, the motion for prayer wasn't followed through because there wasn't any money to hire someone to function sort of as a chaplain there. But nonetheless, the people took it up on their own initiative, and they began praying in their own quarters and praying in small groups. And that action actually brought harmony and restoration, and progress began to be made following Franklin's motion for prayer. So again, here, when people are telling us, you know, these bunch of secularists, they wanted to establish a neutral attitude towards religion, they didn't want prayer in public and all, that's an absolute lie from the very historical details and facts of what took place in the convention itself. They were relying upon God's direction and God's wisdom, as well as on God's word in structuring what they were putting together in this constitutional convention. Well, it was later in August that a committee on detail was appointed to work out the details of the elements they put together. In August, beginning of August, that committee on detail presented its report, and it was refined until the 8th of September. And then a committee on style was appointed to draft the final wording, and Gouverneur Morris did most of the writing of that final draft. So in terms of the precise wording of things, it's largely his work. And then on September 12th, the Committee on Style presented its report, and the convention considered it and adopted it with just a few minor changes on September 15th, and actually signed it on September 17th, which is why September 17th each year should and has been honored as the day, Constitution Day, because it is a significant event in the history of our nation, just as significant as July 4th. We should be remembering September 17th and having people read through the Constitution. Actually, if you sat down and read through the Constitution, it doesn't take that long. And there at the signing on September 17th, a majority from each state signed. There were three delegates who did not: Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts, George Mason, and Edmund Randolph of Virginia. But Randolph later changed his mind, and he wound up supporting the Constitution.
But I understand that there were 35 people signed it, of the original 55. What?
Yes. And some of those had to return to their businesses, return to their home states, so there wasn't the 55 delegates that were part of the convention, they weren't there during the entire time, you know, that some of them had to return because of business pressure and other things, or family things, so they weren't able to all stay up to the September 17th. Well, as the delegates signed the Constitution, Ben Franklin spoke, and he referred to an etching on the back of George Washington's chair. And I just last fall was up in Philadelphia and was able to stand in Independence Hall and see that very chair.
Hold that thought right there, David. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution, and he's just telling the story of the signing of the Constitution, drawing it up, and then signing it. And as they are finished the signing the Constitution, why, Benjamin Franklin takes the floor, and you tell that wonderful story.
And as he did, he referred to the etching of the sun, which was on the back of George Washington's chair. And if you look at that chair, you see it's half a sun. And the rays from the sun are coming out, but it's only half a sun that's visible. And he said, I've often In the course of the session and the vicissitudes of my hopes and fears as to its issue, looked at that behind the president without being able to tell whether it was rising or setting. But now at length I have the happiness to know that it is a rising and not a setting sun. So he left the convention with great hope that what had taken place there was going to be ratified by the states easily, and then be put into practice with a Congress actually be assembled, first president elected, judiciary established, all that we take for granted today, was very tenuous at that point in time, because as the delegates left the convention and they returned to their home states, there was a great debate that began in each state. Some of the states very readily and easily ratified, for example, Delaware, right away, no problem. They saw it was to their great advantage to jump on board. Other states, like New York and especially Virginia, the larger states, there was a very intense debate that took place. And that debate's important to remember because they understood what they were doing. They understood that they were creating a new form of government that would either bring great blessings of liberty or could bring a disaster upon their heads. Now, as those ratification debates began, actually, it's interesting, a woman is, we don't know exactly her name. At least
her name is Mrs. Powell.
Mrs. Powell.
And you'll find that in Bartlett's quotation. So I've always been fascinated with that and how they even knew, because actually the story was written by Benjamin Franklin's aide, who was standing on the stairs when Mrs. Powell came up to Benjamin Franklin as he's leaving the Constitutional Convention. So tell the story.
Because as she was leaving, or as Ben Franklin was leaving, she wanted to know the answer to one question. What form of government have you given to us, Mr. Franklin? And his response was, a republic, ma'am, if you can keep it. And there should be a great underlining there for Americans today, if you can keep it. A republic is not an easily kept form of government. Actually, it's perhaps the most difficult form of government because it involves, first of all, a high level of understanding on the part of citizens who are actively involved. And again, here's the wisdom of our founders. They said, not every person should vote. Just because you're born and you grow up and you reach age of 18, that doesn't mean you should vote. Instead, they wanted people who would vote, who would understand the form of government very clearly, who would be stakeholders in it, that's why they wanted to be property owners, and would be committed to preserving that same form of government, because they recognize a republic is a very difficult form of government to maintain. And that was a big part of what took place in the ratification debates in all 13 states. Those who were for the Constitution called themselves Federalists, and Federalism really is a term that we don't clearly understand today, but it was simply that it meant that there were shared power between the federal government, what we call what takes place down there in Washington, D.C., a shared power between the federal government and the state governments. In fact, the states had greater powers than the federal government, and the states would act as a check upon the federal government. Dr. Stan, you brought up the very important point that the senators were appointed by the state legislatures, and therefore they were sent to Washington, D.C. to do the bidding of their individual states to prevent Washington from doing anything that the state did not want Washington to do. Of course, with the 17th Amendment, that structure of our founders was destroyed, and the states have been losing their position as power, the design they had in our original system of power ever since. And the federal government has been gaining more and more powers that it was never supposed to have, according to the design of our founders.
And I would comment that there's a man named Bill Benson who was given a great deal of money some years ago, and he actually went around to all the states to check out the ratification of both the 16th and 17th Amendments, and most people know that he found out that most of the states had never ratified the 16th Amendment. But what most people don't know is they didn't ratify the 17th Amendment either, and when my friend D.B. Kidd went to Sacramento here in California to get those original papers on the ratification of, I think, of the 16th Amendment, these books are still there going back to the early 1900s, and somebody had simply taken out the pages. So you didn't know what had happened. History has simply been removed from the records. They don't want you to know that neither the 16th nor the 17th Amendments were ever ratified. Well, David, you pick up the story there and run with the ball.
Yes, well, as the debates continued, of course, the Federalists began to do adequate arguing in each of the states, and Hamilton, Madison, and John Jay actually penned a series of articles that were published in the newspaper that became known as the Federalist Papers. And they were written in New York because they were trying to argue for the ratification of the Constitution in New York. And the Federalist Papers are very important because many people say, well, you know, David, we can't get back to the founders' view of government. We don't even know what the founders believed. We just have this Constitution, and we really don't know what they mean by the words on the paper. Well, that's a lie. We do know what they meant because they explained in detail what they meant. After all, James Madison is called the father of our Constitution because he was the one who not only shaped, well, the agenda for the Constitution Convention, but major portions of the Constitution were under his hand and guidance, so he understood the Constitution. After all, he was the one primarily responsible for its shape. So he and Hamilton and Jay wrote these essays, and if you read the Federalist Papers, you can discover exactly what they meant in what the details are of the Constitution. And, of course, there's other writings, but the Federalist Papers are probably the best source. There's the debates themselves that James Madison kept his notes, and there's some others, and we can get back to understand what our founders want, and we can actually return to the form of government that they bequeathed to us. Now, the others opposing the Constitution's ratification had a disadvantage. They were not intimately familiar with the details of the Constitution. They didn't see any of it until September 17th, so they were a little bit behind, but here were some of the arguments that they put forward. They said Congress has authorized the convention only to revise the Articles of Confederation, which is true. And they said Congress did not give them permission to create a new constitution. However, the answer to that is in the ratification. In other words, the Articles of Confederation could only be changed or amended if all 13 states agreed to any amendment. And of course, because Rhode Island never showed up, they knew, well, Rhode Island couldn't be part of doing this, so they knew right from the beginning they had a real problem with that provision of the Articles. So, but they said, if we propose a new constitution, only those states that choose to be part of this are going to be part of this. It's not being forced upon states like, for example, Rhode Island. They held out to the very end. They didn't have to ratify the constitution. They could have remained an independent nation separate from the other 12 states had they chosen to do that. Furthermore, the argument was that there was a lack of Bill of Rights, and they said this is dangerous, and I believe they were absolutely right.
Well, that's out there, right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. Before we get to what the complaints were about the Constitution by the anti-federalists and why they opposed this Constitution, I want David to get out his telephone number and, of course, his website so that those of you out across America can learn how to get in touch with his organization and how you can set up an Institute of the Constitution in your community. If the people don't understand our form of government, how can we maintain it? And that's why every month David is here on this program with me and, of course, traveling across the country, helping communities all across this nation begin to rekindle that flame of understanding of the foundation of our freedom, which is the Bill of Rights, the Declaration of Independence, and the Constitution of the United States. So how can people get in touch with you, David?
Dr. Stan, they can give us a call toll-free at 866-730-9796 and order our host kit, which is a very simple way for anyone with any group of people to actually communicate these principles. We say you're hosting a class, not teaching it, because basically you're pulling together a group of people, putting the video lectures in of Dr. Eidsmo, 12 half-hour lectures, and the host kit contains a notebook, a student notebook with a detailed outline of each of those lectures. a host manual that gives you, the host, the exact instructions of how to conduct the class, all the materials you need to conduct a class, so you don't have to be an expert in the Constitution or in history to do this. And we're encouraged as thousands of Americans are actually taking action here and beginning to educate their fellow citizens about these things, because we know the news media is never going to tell the truth about the Constitution. Certainly the judges are never going to tell us the truth, and the school system all over, both secondary education as well as college education, university education, and law schools, they're not going to tell the truth. We've got to get around all those barriers that are set up by the evil one-worlders who are trying to destroy our constitutional republic, and the way to do it is to go to We the People. That's where it all started, with We the People, and We the People can retake America. We can do it by teaching not only ourselves and our families, our church members. Every church in America that believes the Bible should be doing a class like this and teaching God's Word, what God's Word says about law and government, what our founders believed. And so they can call our toll-free number to order a host kit. It's 866-730-9796. So they can actually also go on our website and order online. Our website is IOTConline, all one word, IOTConline.com. And there's other resources available there to help them as well in this. And I'm encouraged because there's many people that are beginning to understand what's taken place is that the Constitution given to us by our founders has been shredded, basically. And the current federal government is not abiding by almost any of the limitations. We need to understand, again, the design of the Constitution was to say this is all the federal government can do. It can do X, Y, and Z here, especially Article 1, Section 8, when we get to that in next month, probably looking at the details. This is all they can do, nothing more. Well, people have been persuaded that that's not the case. In other words, the original intent of the Constitution has been trampled upon, and now the federal government does 99% of what it does is against and in violation of the Constitution and its provisions. So to retake our land means citizens need to understand and understand the original intent of the Constitution and then hold their elected officials accountable. And if those elected officials will not be held accountable, we need to throw them out of office and put people in their place who will abide by the original intent of the Constitution.
Now, one more time, the telephone number and the website.
Our toll-free number is 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796 for Institute on the Constitution. And our website is IOTConline.com. All one word, IOTConline.com.
And that's why it was so important to the people who want an all-powerful government to convince us that we're a democracy. Yet you'll never find the word democracy in the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, or the Declaration of Independence, or even in the Federalist Papers, other than to say we don't want a democracy. Mm. And you must understand that in a republic, it's a government of laws. Today, we have a government of men, and the men can do just about whatever they want to, and that's what the Supreme Court is doing as well. We have, for all intents and purposes, an authoritarian, elitist society that is in violation of our own Constitution, and by the definitions of the Patriot Act, these people are terrorists because they want to change our form of government. That's the definition of terrorism in the Patriot Act. And so we need, first of all, to understand why these people are doing the wrong thing, and then to reclaim our heritage so it can be passed on to generations yet unborn. So with that as a background, pick up the story, David.
Well, the Anti-Federalists had some other arguments. They were very strong arguments, not only that there was not a Bill of Rights, and that was dangerous, and therefore, in many of the state ratification conventions, there was an agreement made that there will be a Bill of Rights, and if as soon as we ratify this, we're going to submit a Bill of Rights to the Congress, and eventually, when we get to look at the Bill of Rights, we'll note how important each of the protections against an overarching and overreaching federal government were in those first 10 amendments that were with the Bill of Rights. The Anti-Federalists also had some good arguments in saying that judicial review could be dangerous. In other words, they saw that the Supreme Court could be a very dangerous body that had to be carefully dealt with. And we see in our day they're absolutely right, because we know that our form of government, the republic, has been undermined more powerfully by that branch of government than by the other two. Although the president's done much to destroy, and as Congress has as well, the Supreme Court has done the most to destroy our form of government. So the anti-federalists had some good arguments, and nonetheless, they didn't have a better system. In other words, obviously the Articles of Confederation were not working. They were a disaster. We barely survived the War for Independence functioning with the Articles of Confederation, and they didn't have a better system. But they did have some good criticism that once it was listened to and applied, did make a difference, particularly in the Bill of Rights. And so the Constitution ratification conventions went on. Delaware ratified unanimously right away, December 6th of the same year, 1787. And just a few days later, Pennsylvania ratified, and then New Jersey ratified, as well as Georgia, all in the month of December there. And Connecticut the following month in January and February, Massachusetts, then Maryland, my state, ratified in April of the following year. By May, South Carolina came on board, and New Hampshire in June. And when New Hampshire ratified it, it was the ninth state to ratify, and as the ratification clause of the Constitution said, it had to be nine states. The Constitution became the supreme law of the land at that point, June 21st, 1788. Then Virginia ratified shortly thereafter in June, and July New York did, and North Carolina in November. But little old Rhode Island, they held out to 1790. It was they were the last ones on board, and I think they probably recognized that there were more advantages to being part of the Constitution, part of this these United States, small u, than being separate from it, being their own nation, which they could have. You see, the idea is that this was a voluntary compact, a voluntary covenant of these 13 independent sovereign states that were joining together in the Union. It was not a forced union. It was a voluntary union. And this is an important principle to remember because it was tested, and unfortunately the test failed in the war between the states, or I like the phrase that some use here. It was our second war for independence. It was the one we lost. We won the first one, we lost the second one, because the principle died in that. It's still alive. Actually, I know there's a number of states and a number of movements going on today talking about secession. But if you voluntarily joined this union, obviously you could voluntarily leave this union, which is what the southern states said there when they formed the Confederate States. And Lincoln said, no. You came into this union, and as soon as you came in, it was no longer voluntary, and the only way you're going to leave this union is in a body bag. Well, that is a false idea that no American believed, and everybody in that day understood that each state had the right to secede from the union if it chose to. After all, up in New England, it was very anti-slavery. The New England states a few years earlier had actually had a convention that met in Connecticut, and they talked about seceding from the union. They voted not to do so, but they knew they had the right to do so if they chose to. The Middle Atlantic states, also there was talk about secession. They never actually got to voting on it in a convention. And then obviously the southern states, South Carolina being the first, knew they had the right to secede because it was a voluntary association bringing together by covenant. And if that covenant was broken, and you see, that was the issue that the southern states took up. They said, the covenant that we had with our civil government has been broken. And therefore, if that covenant's been broken, we have a God-given right to secede from the Union. And I would say today, we clearly have even a greater right than the southern states did because the covenant has been broken. If you study, as we're going to in succeeding studies, as we look at the details of the Constitution, we recognize again and again and again, in detail after detail after detail, how our current government is violating the law. And you look, the Constitution says it is the supreme law of the land. That means no presidential edict, no judicial activism on the part of the Supreme Court, no judicial opinion issued by the Supreme Court. None of that stuff can override the supreme law of the land. No legislation passed by Congress can override the supreme law of the land unless it's an amendment to that Constitution.
And of course, it's so hard to amend it, so they simply put people onto the Supreme Court to violate their oath of office and change our form of government. That is what's so unconscionable. And what's even more inconceivable is the American people have been so dumbed down, they don't even understand what's happening, and they really have lost their desire for freedom. But I believe that there are increasing numbers of people who do value their freedom. And I think, you know, it's a, as I study more and more, I find it's usually the ones who've not been to college who've got a lot more common sense than those of us who have.
And the people all over the country I talk to are recognizing the loss of liberty, even if they don't understand the details. And they recognize something is really wrong here when Terri Schiavo can be murdered and 42 million babies can be murdered, and when people's property rights are not secure anymore. Up in New London, Connecticut, they stole those people's property. And I just read a week ago about a little town, Coleman, Alabama, where they're stealing the property of people who homesteaded that land and owned that land for 115 years. I mean, it's happening all over America. And I think Americans are beginning to wake up and say, we're in trouble. If we don't stand up and defend our God-given rights, we're going to lose them. And we're all going to be slaves of this one-world government, which is exactly what that one-world government is planning for us, not freedom, but slavery for every single one of us. And so now is the time for people to rise up and say, I must do something. And that's why I'm so excited to be part of the Institute on the Constitution, Dr. Stan, because here's something everybody can do. You know, maybe not everybody can run for Congress, or not everybody could, you know, be elevated to the bench somewhere, but everybody can teach their community, starting with their own family, starting with their home church, which, if it's a Bible-believing church, should put on a program like this where it teaches what God's law says. It teaches what your duties as a Christian citizen are in this country. And that's what our program is designed to do. And so I'm encouraged as Americans are taking up the mantle and doing the first step. It's the first step in restoring the republic, teaching millions of Americans these truths about our Constitution, Declaration, and our Bill of Rights.
And the thing that's so easy about it is all you have to do is have a video recorder and, mm-hmm. and to play the tapes. And you even have a book that tells you what the questions are.
That's right.
That gives you the answer to the question, so that if they come up with the wrong answer, why, you've got the right answer. So it's really a turnkey situation mm-hmm. where you can teach just like a college professor could, and the people will learn. They will learn what they've never been taught in school. Less than once our founding fathers, you know, and for 150 years everybody knew these things, but they have not been taught in our schools for the last 50 to 75 years because, of course, the people who control the educational system don't want people to understand the miracle of our Constitution.
That's right, and we tell people, because I know a lot of people are afraid when they hear the idea that, well, they're going to be even hosting a class, not teaching, but hosting a class on the Constitution. They're afraid that in the course of that class, somebody's going to raise their hand and ask a question they don't know the answer to. It's like, oh, I would just be terrified and embarrassed for that to happen. Well, the Institute on the Constitution, we promise them, we've got a email address that they can email us that question, or they can call us on the phone or toll-free number and tell us that question as soon as that class is over or the next day, and we'll get the answer back to them in a week. So by the time their class meets, if they're meeting once a week, by the time the class meets again, the host can say, you know, I didn't have the answer to this question last week, but now I've got the answer, and I want to share it with you. And I've even done some phone calls on speakerphone with the class and taken questions and interacted actually up there in the desert of California. There was a group that had some questions about the Constitution, and the host didn't feel confident even speaking and sharing the questions that were coming, so I got on the speakerphone with them and said, hey, let me just share what I understand and my knowledge of the Constitution with you, and it worked well. So I want to encourage your listeners that they can do this. This, any American who's committed to finding out the truth themselves and sharing it with their fellow citizens can do this and should do this, because this is what's necessary to retake our land from those evil one-worlders who really want to enslave every one of us, as you shared in so much of your research, Dr. Stan.
Well, I certainly encourage everybody out there to go to that number, 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. And at least inquire about getting a packet for the Institute of the Constitution and begin doing something to save America. So we got about 2 minutes for you to wrap up the program here. No, I guess we have about, we'll go to the break, and then you'll have a few minutes after that. Go ahead.
Great. Well, let's talk about the preamble and remind ourselves that the real introduction to the Constitution is the Declaration of Independence. All that's stated in the Declaration is the purposes of government. It's the foundation under which everything else comes. And in a sense, the preamble we have to the Constitution is very short because the preamble is only doesn't need to restate everything stated by the Declaration. It starts off with the phrase, "We the people." And this shows that governmental power is derived from the consent of the governed. In other words, if you have this idea in your mind that I give the government permission to do its job, and if I have given the government permission to do this specific job, they have no more permission outside of that that I have given them to do. The government doesn't decide the limits on its own powers. We the people decide the limits on the powers, and we decided it by the framing that we gave it in the Constitution.
Amen to that. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, we'll go ahead.
And this shows that the framers' view was a covenantal or a contractual nature of governmental authority. It was a spiritual thing that was taking place here between we the people, our civil government, and between the Lord Jesus Christ, as we see from the last clause of the Constitution.
Amen to that. And Chris, anybody who says they don't mention our Lord in that, why, they've never read the Constitution.
That's right.
We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. All right, David, you got 3 minutes to wrap up.
Okay, well, the phrase there in the preamble is the purposes. They state the purposes for which this government is being formed, and those purposes are to form a more perfect union, because they had experienced a great deal of disunity during the Articles of Confederation era, disunity between the states treating each other as foreign nations and so on. The second thing was to establish justice, provide an orderly and fair court system. And of course, here we need to remember that this recognizes that there is an absolute standard, a fixed standard. There is such a thing as justice. Stealing a person's property, is that by that standard, is that just or unjust for the government to steal people's property? There is a way to determine what is just and what is not just. Of course, it goes all the way back to God's law, which is the basis upon which English common law, which, by the way, English common law became American common law, but all of that was based upon God's Word, the Bible. To establish justice was the second purpose for which this Constitution was being structured. The third purpose was to ensure domestic tranquility. They had had a series of insurrections that were threatening each individual state under the Articles of Confederation, and they were going to deal with that with a specific structure they were establishing. The fourth purpose was to provide for the common defense. Now, the framers believed in defense, and that they had difficulty in providing for the common defense under the system of voluntary requisitions. That is, when the war for independence was being fought, the Congress could say to the states, please send money, you know, George Washington and his troops, they need clothing, they need bullets, they need gunpowder, and we don't have the money for it. Please, would you send some money? And, you know, if the states had some extra cash left over, or if they felt like it, they would send the money along whenever they chose. So there was no real way that the common defense in a time of war could be provided for effectively with that system of voluntary requisition. So that was the fourth. The fifth was to promote the general welfare. And it's very important to understand that general welfare means that everybody benefits. For example, common defense. If we were attacked by a foreign nation, say Mexico attacked us, and the common defense would benefit the entire United States by defending us from attack and invasion. But the common or general welfare does not mean the welfare of specific individual or even specific groups. Say, well, we're going to benefit everybody from 65 and over by these legislative actions. That's not common.
And of course, they didn't provide welfare for the general welfare. They promoted the general welfare.
That's right.
Provide for the common defense, but promote the general welfare.
Exactly.
We're out of time, David. God bless you. We'll
thank
look
you
forward
so much.
Next month. Bye-bye.
God bless.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening has been Pastor David Whitney, and we were just talking about the preamble to the Constitution, that where it says that form a perfect union, establish justice, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. And it's a very important differentiation. You provide for the common defense, but you promote the general welfare. You don't provide for the general welfare. There was no idea that it was to be the function of the central government to provide for the people. Because the government that can provide whatever you need, has got to be able to take whatever you have. And the government that can provide for you from the cradle of the grave has got to be able to control you from the cradle of the grave. Our founding fathers wanted that, and they wanted people to be free. It's so important that you understand the Constitution. We have a four-tape set on the foundations of our freedom, a series of interviews I've done with Dr. James Herson, and of course we have so many books and information and tape sets and videos going into the background of this wonderful form of government we have. And if you'd like to know more about it, I suggest you go to our website of RadioLiberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com, and you can you'll get an idea of what is available there. Certainly you can pull down our newsletters, and we have a number of them there, going into the difference between a republic and a democracy, and why our form of government was superior to any other that has ever been created by the hand of man. And I really believe it was divinely inspired. I believe that there has never been any society where people have had more freedom than we've had here. But then, of course, that's when we were a godly nation. We are no longer a godly nation. Again, our website, www.radioliberty.com. You can listen to us on the Internet 5 hours a day on the various networks we're on. You can listen to our programs 4 hours a day on shortwave. And very soon, we'll be available on the KU satellite. And we'll tell you more about that when we're up and actually broadcasting there. But, of course, you can get a KU satellite and listen to our programs. And those are those people who are with us, who will be working with us. It would be Pastor Chris Meyer and Joyce Riley and Butch Palm. And they'll be available 24 hours a day on a KU satellite. And if you'd like more information, you can always call us at 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of our latest newsletter, it's called Peak Oil 2. Why is your utility bill going up? Why is your electricity bill going up? Why is your heating oil going up? Well, you probably believe that there are shortages, that somehow we've run out of dinosaurs. That's why there's no more oil and methane or natural gas. Oh, it was all dinosaurs that they died, and there were just millions of them over there on the sands of Saudi Arabia, and that's why they have billions of barrels of oil, all those dead dinosaurs. If you believe that, why, you've got too much college education. I know I used to believe that sort of thing until somebody pointed out really the stupidity of the dinosaur theory of the origin of oil and methane. So you'll want to get our newsletter, Peak Oil Part 2, and of course we'll be glad to send it to you free of charge if you call us at 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, please pray for America. Pray for revival, because we're involved in a spiritual battle. Pray for Radio Liberty for our provision and our protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Jerry Guidetti from the ARC Institute. Hi, Jerry. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Dr. Stan. How about yourself?
Well, I'm doing fine, except I had too much to eat yesterday and again today. But we'll be over this by the end of December, and then we can get back to our regular form of life. I love this time of year, though.
It's
my favorite time of year.
It's a wonderful time of year. Lots of good sentiments abound, you know, within families, and I think that's great. And we do indulge too much, but as you say, we have ample opportunity also to make amends later on and
right.
Live better.
And of course, I think that I will not go with this idea. This is a holiday season. This is Christmas season, and certainly do not let them change your way of writing, or, you know, X for Christmas. No, it's Christmas.
No.
This is what it's all about. Despite the fact there are people out there who hate Christianity and are doing everything they can to destroy its remembrance.
It's a very sad thing, isn't it?
It certainly is. But
yeah.
Let's get into some of the things I know that you're concerned about, preparation and the things that are going on in the world. So you pick up the story of what's happened since we talked last.
Well, since we talked last, certainly if we look at the bird flu situation, the reasons for us to have to be prepared for untoward events and for uncertain times is certainly there. I don't know if you've been following it, Stan, but the Canadian situation has really gotten worse.
Well, tell us what's happened up there. We heard that sure. They had a case of bird flu, but it wasn't the H5N1.
Yes, well, they do have H5N1, as a matter of fact.
They have now, huh?
Oh, yes, it's H5N1, but what they're claiming is that it doesn't have the mutations in it that make it the dangerous Asian serotype. But then all of those tests aren't done yet, and they've only done some 11, or released the data anyway, on some 11 out of hundreds of cases, claiming that those 11 did not have the mutations that make it as dangerous. But in the meantime, they are, in fact, killing off preemptively thousands of birds up in British Columbia. We now have, I believe it's the fourth farm involved.
Now, are these chickens are killing?
These are commercial ducks, and they're killing some geese as well. These were commercial, the ones that they found a sick duck on a line, and they said, at first they had said that they had taken the duck off the commercial line, and these were animals that were being slaughtered for, I guess, holiday eating or freezers. And one of those animals came off the line, and they did a test on it and found out it had H5. Well, soon we found out that it was not just H5, but H5N1. And so that poor farmer, all of his animals had to be slaughtered, and they culled all of those. And then they placed up a quarantine around a huge area, which included some four farms.
Now, is this British Columbia, or where is it?
Yes, well, and we have many other places in Canada that have it, but British Columbia is where this has happened, yes.
Right.
And so then they went ahead and tested others, and now they have several other farms involved as well.
No, well, that's certainly it's spread far much more than I've been able to follow, but
yes.
Then that's why I have to rely on you to keep me abreast of what's going on. So
basically,
they are then killing, what, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I can get the latest data today, but they were killing thousands of birds, and this is commercial birds.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and certainly this bird flu has had quite an impact on birds. We know they've killed something like 150 million birds.
Oh, many more than that now. Oh, many, many more than that now. China has exploded, literally. Vietnam has exploded. Jakarta, now Indonesia, has just received the okay from Roche in Switzerland to generically produce Tamiflu, just in the hopes that they're going to slow this down. But China, unfortunately, has been announcing 1 to 2 more towns and villages a day. They're calling the situation grim and grave. They are slaughtering animals like crazy. Now the underground news agency Baksun has reported that it wasn't 3 humans that have died, but rather 310 humans that have died, and 7,000 are under observation or in quarantine. And there was a doctor from the World Health Organization, a Japanese man, who recently spoke in Germany just about 3-4 days ago in Germany at a science conference on bird flu, and he released the information that doctors in China have surreptitiously given him the information that it was over 300 humans are dead and 7,000 are quarantined. And that news, he said, came from very reliable sources. Then Baksun follows up, this underground news agency follows up and says that several of these doctors were arrested for having revealed this information, and they are denying hands down that they have that many dead people over in China.
But of course they would have reason not necessarily to be honest, because the last thing that they would want would be to have some sort of a quarantine on their country that would cut down tremendously, certainly on their tourism. Tourism is a fairly substantial thing, but even more so would be a quarantine of goods coming from China, communist China.
Oh yes, for sure. And don't forget, Walmart is the major buyer of all those goods from China. I mean, that is their whole business is based upon it. But more than that, China is building up for the Olympics in 2008. And Beijing, you know, is going to host the Olympics. And so this is a very serious situation. Globally, it's a serious situation. But for China, it's also a huge economic loss if this happens. For example, this is today's story. China called the bird flu a serious epidemic and reported 3 new outbreaks, that's just today, of the deadly virus in different parts of the country, while Canada announced multiple new cases, but stressed they are not the virulent strain that is sweeping across Asia. China's
hold that thought right
yes,
there, Jerry.
Sure.
Hold that thought right there. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Jerry was saying, and certainly we've read this, these stories that there's a material coming out of China that 300 people have died. Now, Chinese government is certainly denying that, but you would expect the Chinese government would lie. I mean, why should we be surprised that they would lie? The stories that we're getting is that the doctors who have surreptitiously stuck this information out to the World Health Organization have been arrested. Because China, if she is in the middle of a major H5N1 epidemic, doesn't want that word out. Why? Well, it would hurt tourism. Remember the story of Jaws? And oh my goodness, we couldn't tell anybody there was a shark in the water there. Why? It would be bad for tourism here at the beach. And then, of course, China could not afford to have their goods cut off, so they couldn't be taken out of the country. And so there would be many reasons why China would not want to keep this information secret, but there have been several stories, and apparently they're fairly reliable stories, that there are people that are dying in China from the bird flu. And then, of course, as far as the birds, why, it's just decimating the bird herds or their flocks or whatever they say. They're talking about injecting over, I don't know, how many billion birds.
Yes.
Go ahead. You pick up the story.
Yeah, the Chinese are expecting to inject billions with vaccine. Of course, the vaccines are being rushed, and this isn't human vaccine. This is bird vaccine, and unfortunately, a lot of scientists don't agree that this should be happening because the viruses themselves can be developing immunity from a lot of these faulty vaccinations. So it seems like an overwhelming task, and it probably is an overwhelming task, and the Chinese are losing the battle, as is Canada at this point. up here in Vancouver, for example, again, here's today's story in Vancouver. Further tests show avian influenza is rife, R-I-F-E, on a farm where a duck tested positive for the virus. The ability of the virus to quickly spread and amplify in such conditions is precisely why we have activated preemptive depopulation. Read that killing. It said the virus was found in a significant number of the birds tested and 78 farms in the surrounding 5-kilometer radius will be placed under quarantine Wednesday night if they haven't already been locked down. And so they've got it at 2 duck farms in the Fraser Valley in British Columbia. They've culled thousands of ducks and hundreds of geese at the 2 sites, and they're going on and on. Now we also have it in Quebec, in Manitoba. We have it on the eastern coast of Canada, up in Newfoundland. They've been finding them there. So since many of these cases were found, the initial cases were found in August of this year, those initial samples, Stan, we have to presume that H5 is here, at least in the northern part of the United States. The question is it H5N1, is it the H5N1 with mutations that make it extremely virulent for both birds and then able to jump into the human species? They've been saying that they've been finding some low pathogenic H5N1, the LPAIs, or low pathogenic avian influenza H5N1s. But Dr. Nyman and others have pointed out that the mutations from low pathogenic to high pathogenic occur now so easily when we have great numbers like this, that now we know it is just a matter of time before we find our first dead flocks here in Canada and the United States, if not already. We already had some dead ducks up there in these commercial facilities. We have to be concerned about the bagged, frozen duck, for example. Folks should realize that once these animals are cooked, it is safe to eat them. But you really have to consider, even considering salmonella and Campylobacter jejuni that's in carcasses of all kinds of poultry, you have to be very specially careful in processing poultry in your home. And use your normal, you know, if you are used to being careful, be extra careful. And we don't want to see people lose their poultry as food, you know, for their families. And so just be careful processing it at this point. They're claiming that there is no H5N1 in any commercial birds yet. I would just say keep your ear pressed to the ground and stay tuned in for that, because we certainly do have it now in North America, and it's only a matter of time before we start seeing it breaking out here in the United States as well. I don't know that we can really keep it down. So,
well, I think the thing that's most frightening to me is the fact that the President of the United States has talked about using a military dictatorship here should there be a pandemic. Now, he has no right to do that. He does not have the right under the Constitution. He does not have, and he's talking about using the military here in a police capacity to control the population. The military is not trained for that. The military is trained for combat. They're trained for killing people, not for controlling civilian populations. And yet the president, in his wisdom, wants to violate the Constitution, and the fact that he would even be talking about this, you know, is rather frightening, showing he really doesn't understand or believe in the Constitution he's sworn to uphold. And what would happen if they had another reason that they wanted to say, my goodness, we've got this, it might be here, maybe we just better slap on this total control? Sounds incredible, sounds paranoid. I think you're only paranoid when you imagine people are against you, and when the President of the United States comes out and makes the statements he's been making. That really bothers me. How about you, Jerry?
Oh, well, certainly bothers me. As a matter of fact, most biologists, most epidemiologists, and medical personnel were shocked when we heard the Rose Garden speech saying, well, yes, we are considering using the military. How else to control whole regions of the United States? I saw that interview. I heard that interview with my own eyes and ears, and I sat there with my mouth gaped open. I've been worried about such a thing. You can control, for example, the influx and efflux of trucks and cars, which, of course, will have to happen if you've got contaminated grounds on farms or whatever, but you are not going to stop an epidemic that is spread by droplets through the air. What you can do is you could ring off a whole region of a country and prevent influx and efflux, as I said. But don't forget, Stan, we are a nation completely dependent on one another on shipping for imports from other countries and shipping of those imports to our communities for everything, for our oil, for example, for our food, for water purification chemicals, for just about everything that we have. We depend on trucks. Can you think of anything that doesn't depend on transportation to get it to us? And so we're looking at a situation where if these quarantines go into effect and these roadblocks and so on go into effect, which is what the government's talking about using, you're looking at families having to rely on themselves. And I think I said on your program the last time that if you go to the Department of Health and Human Services, DHHS.gov, you go there and look up the nation's pandemic plan. We've got the plan out there now. Read down to the part about community preparedness. You will find that the government has stated clearly, do not expect a top-down solution. We are not going to bring MREs to your doorstep. And we all saw that in Katrina. We saw that in Rita. We saw that in Wilma. There isn't going to be food and water brought to your doorstep. In fact, they suggest that the faith-based organizations are going to do this. Well, I ask you, look around in your particular neighborhood, in your city, in your community, and do you know of too many faith-based organizations that are equipped and manned and womaned to the point where they can deliver all of your basic food supplies and needs to your door?
Well, I think that you could, if there was something like that happened in Mississippi and Louisiana, certainly you had the Southern Baptist Convention, and you had the Salvation Army there. But you're talking about one localized area, two states out of 50. You're
right.
Talking about the entire country,
right.
And of course the Southern Baptists and the Salvation Army are not equipped to do the whole country, and that is the real problem we have. And I think the other thing is people have to understand what FEMA stands for, the Federal Emergency Management Agency.
Right.
Not providing for you. It's management. It's management. It's control of people. It has nothing at all to do with providing for people. So I think Jerry's point is well made. People are going to have to start thinking about looking after themselves. And
right.
This is one of the pleas that we make repeatedly over our programs, and we believe it with all our heart and soul. You have got to start looking out for yourself, and you need to get your neighbors to start thinking about this. And when I heard, it was yesterday, that there had been 300 people who died in China. Now, whether this is the regular flu, whether it's the bird flu, what it is, we don't know. But we do know one thing, and that is the Chinese government is keeping it secret. And if there's nothing to conceal, I always say, why are they concealing it? So pick up the story, Jerry.
Right. Well, they have everybody in the world right now is concealing the reality, or at least they're trying not to cause panic, because the reality of the situation is people are going to react in a panic fashion. I have been asking for 3 years now that if people will prepare, they will have no reason to panic, because preparedness gives you a certain sense of confidence. You cannot be the one out there on the lines and in the grocery stores when all of those supplies are running out in days. We have right now under seizure, this week, our government seized incoming shipments of Tamiflu by certain Canadian drug companies that were selling to private citizens here in the United States, because the governments are to receive Tamiflu now, not the people who want to buy it for their families. Because there's not enough in the world, Stan. Not enough in the world to help people treat this virus if they get it. It's not a cure, but it can help to lessen the length of the illness and the severity. And it's been shut off this week and last week. It's been shut off by governments.
All right, well, we're going to hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Jerry Guidetti of the ARC Institute. And our plea to you is, heed what she says. I believe these are perilous times, whether it's the bird flu or something else. But people have to be prepared. And you've got to start making preparations to look after yourself and your family, because the government isn't going to. Well, go ahead, Jerry. Pick up the story.
Sure. Up in Toronto, for example, in Canada, and we have a lot of listeners up in Canada, they actually have pandemic planners now, and today and yesterday they've put out a lot of their plan for the public consumption. And they have asked, please, for greater hospital surge capacity because they don't have the capacity. The United States has even less experience and less capacity than Canada does. We also have less Tamiflu. We have no vaccine, and the vaccine, even if you wanted to take one, will not be ready for another 5 to 6 years. I don't know if anyone saw last Sunday's Meet the Press with Tim Russert, but he had on Julie Gerberding, Dr. Gerberding from the CDC, and Mike Leavitt, and who was the third person, or was it just two? Mike Leavitt, there was a third person. At any rate, Julie Gerberding had said that we would have 300 million doses of vaccine within 6 months after the pandemic struck. Well, my mouth gaped open once again because I knew there was nothing further from the truth than that. And to his credit, Mike Leavitt said, Secretary Leavitt said, there will be no vaccine. To get 300 million doses of vaccine will take between 5 and 6 years. Thank you to Secretary Leavitt for telling the truth. For those folks worried about vaccines going to do weird things to them and so on, you have nothing to worry about because there is no vaccine going to be available. So this isn't a conspiracy for vaccines at this moment, and there won't be any in a heck of a hurry because we don't have the capacity in this country to produce it. So we are stuck with Tamiflu and support antibiotics for microbial infections on top of them, opportunistic infections, and already they're talking about shortages in many of the antibiotics that are normally given for pneumonia and bronchitis after the fact, after the viral infection. We're facing here a potential catastrophe that the world is trying to gear up for, and as we're trying to slowly gear up, Jakarta, Indonesia is exploding with new cases. China is exploding. Vietnam is going crazy. We have many new serotypes and strains over there. It is spread across Europe and across Asia. And frankly, it's now the World Health Organization is talking in the most grim terms that we're just waiting for the day. Which day is it going to be? We're looking at maybe weeks. So folks really have to, if they, you know, I get criticism. Emails, I get nasty emails now and then from folks who say, you know, just trying to stimulate fear. If you could understand, I'm a woman who usually has a big fat smile on my face and I'm cheering people up all the time. And so for me to sit here and make these kinds of statements is really bothersome to me. But they come straight from my heart and from my concern and from my knowledge of the situation. And I stick my professional neck way out there because if they find, you know, if the thing mutates in the opposite direction and the pandemic doesn't happen, well, Jerry Gaddetti's name is mud because she's been out there saying this thing is possible.
But Jerry, it really, people must be prepared.
Yes.
And if the worst should happen, yes, then, of course, at least those who are prepared are not going to panic.
Right.
If it doesn't happen, there's got to be something else happen. So do you
sure.
keep it? We'll be right back in just a moment here. You know, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly I believe we're living in very, very uncertain times. Now, to most people, Christmas is here like it always is, and certainly football is here, and my goodness, you know, certainly most people cannot imagine that the world we live in could change. But I will tell you that I was in Germany after the Second World War. I saw where great cities had stood. I was actually stationed in Mainz, and you know, behind the facades of the new buildings, nothing but rubble. And I went to Cologne, and there the only thing standing in the center of town was a great cathedral. Everything else was destroyed. And, of course, large parts of certainly of Munich and of Frankfurt had been destroyed. I'm sure the people of Germany thought it could never happen there. And I really believe that we are living in very uncertain times. And besides that, I believe that God brings judgment upon nations and societies that turned against him. And is there any reason why God should not allow these things to happen to America? For as Jefferson said, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and his justice cannot sleep forever. So, of course, what needs to be done is people begin realizing that we live in uncertain times, and so heed what Jerry's saying. Go ahead, Jerry.
Sure. Now, I have come across several things. I've been looking and looking for people, you know, how can they take care of themselves at home? They're talking about, and they finally did come out and say, 3 weeks is dirt minimum, all total supplies you have to have for yourself and your family. So
So you could quarantine yourself.
Quarantine
in
yourself.
Your home.
Self-quarantine. Yes.
Right.
Go back to the Bible even. When the angel of death went through the villages at the Passover, and there was blood painted on the front of every door, and those people who were inside with these closed doors are the ones who made it while this angel of death swept by. Well, if you think of it that way, this is a repeat of that same kind of scenario. What those people were doing was self-quarantining. I mean, let's look at it for what it was. It's self-quarantining, and we've had pandemics from the beginning of time. That was a pandemic. They called it the angel of death. It was a pandemic. And a pestilence will happen every single century. What I've been looking for is, what is the simplest thing? People ask us that all the time. I stumbled upon a book that I have had since pre-Y2K, written by Dr. Berry. He's an MD. He's an ER physician. And he has a very large practice in Tennessee. And he wrote a book called Plain Talk Medicine for Uncertain Times and Places. Now, it's out of print. I have 100 copies. As a matter of fact, I probably only have 80 copies left. I have given one to every member of my family. I bought one for them. It is so good, Stan, because you look inside, and what it does is it tells you how to take care of yourself and your children if they get bronchitis, if they get pneumonia, if they get this, that. They have flow charts he has in there, how to determine what symptoms mean, what things, and so on. He did this for people. He says an ER doctor's practical guide for surviving at home and abroad. I personally think everyone needs a copy in their home. It's not expensive. It's $20, and that includes the shipping. And this thing, I have used it to find out what's the first line of defense antibiotics, what's the second line, and so on. And the reason I recommend folks get that and read Dr. Berry's work is because if you have to be indoors, and if you come down with that flu or even regular influenza, and you then develop other opportunistic bacterial infections, you know, regular pneumonia, bronchitis, and so on, you need to be able to help yourself. You need to be able to talk to your doctor now about prescribing the antibiotics that are recommended here, tell them the reason why, or at least be able to call a medical professional from your home when this thing is going through and saying, look, this is what we need here. We need Bioxin. We need amoxicillin, or so on. And some folks are able to get antibiotics at this time just to have on hand in case, because it's not going to help you against the bird flu, but if 1918 is any indication, it's the secondary infections that follow up that will surely put down those who have managed to get through the viral infection. Now, we might also remind folks that this virus is currently still at the 52% fatality rate, which is way higher than 1918, and it hasn't diminished yet. So we're looking at an exceedingly serious situation. So remind me, Stan, and I'll tell people, you know, more ideas for kinds of things they can prepare for when you come back.
All right, well, we'll be back here in just a moment with Jerry Guidetti, and we're talking about the unthinkable. A major flu epidemic, influenza epidemic. We don't know if it's going to come or not, but I think having antibiotics on hand is a very good idea. If you can get them from your doctor, fine. Well, if not, why, they're available at the veterinary store. You can buy them for your dog, but you can't buy them for yourself. The vets are cutting back on vaccinations for their animals, but we're increasing the vaccinations for our people. We live in a world gone mad. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Jerry Guidetti, and we're just talking about what's happening throughout the world. Now, this epidemic really is, of course, decimating the birds, and it has gotten into the human population. Tell me what's going on in, you were mentioning, I believe, Indonesia, where I had heard of a couple of cases over there. Have there been any more of human cases?
Oh, yes, there have been, and there have been many human clusters as well. Now we have, I think, the World Health Organization confirmed 7 deaths and many more infections, but the unconfirmed are the parts that people are so concerned about. They said basically that they have no idea how many real infections have occurred. As a matter of fact, hospitals are being built over there at U.S. government expense because of the situation, and Vietnam is building huge number of hospitals. I believe I read 100 hospitals. And they're building a lot of them on the border with Cambodia because we have Cambodian infections. And Cambodia is so much poorer even than Vietnam. And so people are streaming across the border for medical treatment in Vietnam. The situation really is already pandemic in Asia, although the technical definition of pandemic is around the world everywhere. It is epidemic. It is pandemic in birds. It has now gone around the world in birds. It is epidemic in humans. It is going, getting worse. It appears that we have, at least Boxen is reporting, that among the 310 dead, that 7 of those situations in China were human-to-human transmission. And that, as all of your folks are probably aware from listening to us before, the efficient transmission from human to human is the one link that will, that one factor will make this thing pandemic in just 2-3 days. It would be around the world in maximum 2 weeks. Once that efficient transmission occurs, we're already seeing the virus, which is mutating and evolving on a daily basis. We're seeing it much more easily move into mammals. It has moved into dogs now. A dog lying with his owner who was dying of bird flu, the dog also has died. And now we have several dogs who have died, and now they're slaughtering dogs in other countries where bird flu has sprung up. It's killing cats at 100%. The cats who have eaten parts of chickens that have died, or birds, wild birds, and so they're dying 100%. In fact, many doctors are now believing that if we watch the cats, we'll have a pretty good idea. They're like the canaries in the coal mine, only this time it's the cat that we're watching.
Hold that thought right there, Jerry. Sure. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Jerry Guidetti. Jerry, before we go on, I want you to get your telephone number out and your website so people can get in touch with you. And, of course, Jerry is from the Ark Institute, and the Ark Institute produces seeds. And, of course, those seeds really are for all different types of vegetables so that you can actually, you know, have your own sort of a garden. If there's any interruption in the food supply, you could begin, you and your neighbors could begin to grow their own seeds. So pick this story up this year.
Sure. First of all, to reach us at the Ark Institute, you can read a lot of free material on our website. It's Ark, A-R-K, think of Noah's Ark, A-R-K Institute, I-N-S-T-I-T-U-T-E .com, ArkInstitute.com, or call 1-800-255-1912, 1-800-255-1912. What we've been doing, Dr. Stan, on radio all over the country and on the telephone when folks call in, we've been trying to send them information that can help them in a brief outline form see what's happening with bird flu, and on the back of a sheet of paper, the preparedness things they could be doing. And then we recommend that you look at this medical book, Plain Talk Medicine for Uncertain Times and Places, and a book like Country Wisdom and Know-How that has thousands, literally thousands, of self-reliance and self-sufficiency steps and knowledge, from how to grow a tomato plant to how to milk a goat to how to make cheese, how to everything you did. If you ever saw the old series of manuals, how to raise a goat, how to do this, how to do that by Story Publishers, What they did was they took all of those that used to run $5 a piece, and they put them all in one mammoth book that weighs almost 2 pounds. It's huge. And yet the thing is, I think it's only $20. It's unbelievable. We use that here at the Ark Institute. We have been using this information for 30 years because this information started coming out that long ago in pamphlet form, but now it's all under one cover. And we recommend people stop and think what the epidemiologists and medical specialists are telling us in this country right now. Dr. Osterholm, for example, out of CIDRAP, that's the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. You go to his website, their website, it's CIDRAP.com, and you'll end up being directed to the University of Minnesota where they're housed. That website will tell you. Dr. Osterholm has been giving speeches worldwide for 2 years now stating agriculture, food supply, electric, water are all in jeopardy because up to 25 to 50% of the people in the world are going to be infected or taking care of those who are infected, so they're not going to work. Or they're going to be too scared to go to work, and their kids are going to be home because they're going to shut schools down. And so he's saying countries cannot just concentrate on Tamiflu and development of vaccines. They had better get to work right this minute and figure out how are we going to feed the people.
Well, let's get your website and your telephone number just one more time here.
Sure. 1-800-255-1912 or www.arkinstitute.com. Look for the seed packages for self-reliance and self-sufficiency so you can get started, say, February of this year.
All right, now let's get that telephone number out again because you always have to put them out at least two or three times.
Sure, 1-800-255-1912.
1912, okay.
1912, and it's ARK, A-R-K, Institute.com. And you'll find information there on bird flu, and we will send you a flyer with the latest update. I just wrote one yesterday. The latest update on bird flu, where it is and so on, the Canadian situation, I mean, it's here. It's now here in North America. I'm going to predict that by the time Christmas is over, we're going to hear about flocks dying here in Canada and in the United States of highly pathogenic H5N1.
Well, I think it's so interesting that, you know, they've already found at least some of it there, but all we need to do is see what's happened in other parts of the world. We know that certainly in China and in Vietnam and Thailand and Indonesia, there, of course, it's really been wiping out the birds, and then they just had to go in and literally cull them by the hundreds of millions. They've killed hundreds of millions of birds so far. So this is not an imaginary threat. It's having a tremendous impact on the poultry industry. And then, of course, people very often who are working in the poultry industry, these seem to be where most of the people are getting it. There have been a few cases, though, of human to human, and that's what the real fear is, that if this should ever become readily communicable between people, then, of course, you could have a worldwide pandemic.
Right, and it's already, as I say, it's already worldwide and pandemic in birds. We just seem to be following the course. And if you could just see the numbers of different sequences that are appearing in the gene bank, which is where the world's scientists publish genetic sequences, unfortunately, all of them are not showing up there. There are a lot, you know, just aren't being shown up and not being put up there. And for many reasons, a lot of folks, you know, want to keep it to themselves because they don't want anybody to know that this is happening in their country.
Well, I think that's really so interesting what the Chinese are doing. We talked about that earlier, but China is obviously not being forthright. They weren't forthright with what happened with SARS. They simply lied about it until it really was completely out of control in China. And then, of course, they started doing the right thing. But right now, the information that's coming out of China is that they're actually putting physicians in jail who are revealing the fact that there have been large numbers of humans infected and certainly dying. So, you know, this is a little bit scary, the fact that they, you know, are we cannot depend upon the China's. You're talking almost a quarter or at least a fifth of the entire population of the world is in a country that is not being forthright as far as telling the rest of the world what's really going on there.
Right. And as a matter of fact, with respect to China, and this has just come to my desk, this is today's date, today's the 25th. Well, it's already the 26th there. So this is like hours old, this thing. Dr. Toshiro replies to ProMed today. In view of conflicting reports in the media about what Dr. Masato Toshiro actually said in Germany, ProMed has sent him some questions to which he has kindly replied. And again, this is tomorrow in China. Thank you for your email. My answers are, no, I was not in Hunan province. The dates, I have visited there before. Were you part of the WHO mission? I was not a member of the WHO mission this time. He says, you showed a slideshow in Germany showing more than 300 deaths from avian flu. He says, as an example of unauthorized information, I showed a slide which I received from a private source. This indicates more than 200 deaths are distributed in several provinces. And then they ask, you were told that 7 of the cases resulted from human-to-human transmission. He says, the information I received indicated human-to-human transmission cases, although the details were not clear. Regards, Masato Toshiro. And so that just came out just now. And so it's once again confirming that the information, even a slide, pictures, say that in fact that is what's happening over there. And then Boxen was reporting that several of the physicians were arrested afterwards. So that's the latest and the greatest, and we have Chinese translators who are translating for many of us a lot of these articles that are appearing, and they are telling us what those articles say with respect to all of these developments. And unfortunately, you know, as long as things aren't really known, how many people are dead in these villages, how many are dying in the villages in Indonesia, for example, we cannot really get a grip on whether or not that final mutation has indeed occurred. We're expecting that any day now.
Well, I think it's really so interesting because, of course, I've been very interested in the AIDS epidemic.
Yeah.
And, of course, the AIDS epidemic in China has been totally covered up there by the government. And when the doctors came forward and tried to tell, you know, publicly what was going on, they were shipped off to jail. And so China seems to have all this pathological attitude towards the epidemic. Certainly, you know, they were saying there were 80,000 people infected with AIDS, and the real figure was probably closer to 1.5 million.
Yeah.
So they were minimizing this, and they were intentionally incarcerating people who told the truth. So almost a pathological fear of the public learning really what's going on over there that reflects their incompetence and the refusal to do what is logical in the face of a major epidemic. Now, if you had a major epidemic, the thing to do would be to cordon off that area. And, of course, it would same thing here in the United States. But we have public health officials at the state and the local level. We do not need the military coming in with their automatic weapons, you know, and their tanks and their armored personnel carriers and their helicopters to control the population of America. You can do it certainly legally, using the state police, using the public health officers, but apparently the people in Washington, D.C. don't want that. They don't want a local solution. They want a justification for bringing in the federal troops. The Pentagon doesn't believe in it, but George Bush does. And this is really rather frightening to me. I'm far more frightened in many respects of the implications of what would happen if something like this could happen as far as our freedom I'm concerned. Although many people would die, can we really trust the people who have been so victorious over in Iraq to take over control of this country?
Oh, I'll tell you why. Just the thought of that level of incompetence and misjudgment and arrogance frightens the heck out of me. I do know that the best suggestion, and again, this is my opinion, the best suggestion I can make would be that people be able to take care of themselves, that they don't have to venture out if these waves come through. Now, mind you, this doesn't come through in one wave. It usually comes through in 2 to 3 waves, sometimes as many as 4. And the length of time is anywhere from 12 months to 3 years. The average is 18 months. Well, that is a very long time to have to take care of yourself. And when everybody, it's like that horrible nightmare of the Twin Towers, the day that the towers were hit. And there are these people just streaming down the stairs, and all of a sudden somebody comes on the PA system and tells them, it's okay, you can go back up now. It was the tower next door, everything is fine now. And unfortunately, these people, so many of them turned around like sheep to their master's rod, turned around and ran back upstairs again to their offices. And in reality, folks have to start to think for themselves. In 1918, the government said, it's all clear. The first wave had gone through. And they told people, it's okay to go out again. And they opened up the schools again. The public meetings were allowed. And that's when the worst wave hit them. Because that exposure, again, one to the other in close quarters, in public meetings and so on, took off. And that's where so many millions of more people died around the world, is in that second wave. And so you have to really be able to do the self-quarantine thing. Use your wisdom and realize that you're going to be told, okay, we can do commerce again now. We can go out to the stores and buy. Get those credit cards out now. Let's go do it. And the reality is you have to stop back and think, wait a minute. These don't come through in one wave. They come through in 2 or 3. Is it really safe out there? Or should I start a garden? Should I start taking care of myself and my family here? Yeah, money's going to be lean because I'm not going to be able to go out to work. But we should be able to make it if we can take care of ourselves. So folks really need to think about that and really have to start thinking through what it is it takes for themselves as a family to live. For not only a day, do a week, then multiply it times 4, that's 1 month. You need a gallon of water a day per person. Start storing up in case the utilities go down, as Dr. Osterholm has warned everyone they might. Be able to have canned food that you can open up, and please don't depend on your electric can opener. Get yourself one of those swing line or other can openers. Do you know how many people do that? A lot of people do that. They are so used to electric can openers, they don't have a regular. Get a regular can opener and put it with your canned goods so you have it. Buy 2. Go to a dollar-type store. Buy a bunch of them and put them wherever you have canned goods and be able to open cans and get some pop-up cans and get some soul food, some things that are going to make you feel happy and not have food fatigue. And do without the extras these days and provide for your family. So just in case this happens this winter, you're in good stead, because the people who survived, by the way, were the ones whose mothers wouldn't let them go out because they said, look at all the little coffins in the street, and they had them 8 high for blocks and blocks in New York City.
You're talking about 1918 now, right?
1918.
In fact,
right.
I'm reading a book written by some woman. That's a fascinating book. Uh-huh. It's just called The Flu, and certainly talking about the total devastation. In fact, there really weren't enough coffins.
No, there weren't, and there's not here. Dr. Osterholm says we only have 2 weeks of coffins in the United States. In Great Britain, they're going crazy. They're trying to find 200,000 coffins. They don't have them. They look at alternative ways of disposing of bodies. They're already looking at mass grave situations over there. Don't forget, Great Britain has already had their bird flu came in a shipment of birds from Taiwan for house birds. And the first parrot died, and then a whole bunch of finches died, and it turns out it was the finches from Taiwan who had it. Well, where did Taiwan get them? They got a shipment of illegal birds from China. And a whole shipping container was filled with H5N1 birds. And they made their way from Taiwan all the way over to Great Britain.
I think it's amazing, you know, with modern technology how and modern travel, how the flu was able to get up, you know, into Canada. Here, two weeks ago, we didn't have anything in Canada. And, of course, how rapidly this is spreading. And, of course, into England, you know, I wasn't even aware it had gotten in England yet.
Oh, yeah, sure. And it's been in Bulgaria and Greece. And they're so afraid. They're desperately afraid. It's in Yemen, by the way, and Iran. And there are signs of birds dying in Iraq. They're just not confirmed yet by the World Health Organization. If it gets to Africa, they figure the gig is up, literally, because there's just so much wild chicken out and animals, mammals for it to get into. And these poor folks, there's so much HIV there. They haven't a prayer and want to do something. Praying hard would be a really good idea.
All right, well, we're going to be back in just a moment here with Jerry Guidetti. Jerry, let's get your telephone number and your website out one more time.
All right, 1-800-255-1912 and ARK Institute, ARKinstitute.com.
Okay, we'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, Jerry, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program.
Sure. Well, if folks would like to really get serious about this so that they can then ease their minds knowing that they've done their best to prepare for this. Another thing we should add is get some of those alcohol gel cleaners, get regular soap, lots of soap in the house for washing your hands because that's going to be critical, washing your hands all the time. Take care of the short term by getting a gallon of water in the house for every single person in your family for at least a month's length of time in case your water system goes down. Get in short-term supplies of food and then plan on a garden in the springtime because we are expecting that agriculture may be interrupted. We're not going to have imports of oil for our refineries. That's going to be cut down. Everybody's going to cut down global trade overnight. So all of those things we import aren't going to be there. Fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides, and so on will be interrupted. So plan, if you can, even in pots on your patio to get things growing and taking care of yourself. Sprout some of the seeds. Learn how to do that. And learn how to feed yourself, take care of yourself, get some medications in. Think of that Plain Talk medicine book, Country Wisdom and Know-How, outstanding book. For these times, you can even find information in the bioterrorism book on taking care of viruses. Chlorine bleach, for example, is your friend. Get lots of gallons in of cheap chlorine bleach without the flavors, fragrances, no spring fresh anything. Just get regular 5.28% sodium hypochlorite, regular old chlorine bleach, generic is fine. Get that in. The Army recommends 16 drops of water in any contaminated water. 16 drops in a gallon.
16 drops to a gallon, right?
In a gallon, 16. That's for contaminated water. For tap water that you just want extra, you know, clear water, extra clean, 8 drops of chlorine. Then you can throw it through a water filter like the Birkfeld, the British Birkfelds, and they will take the chlorine out of them, and so will the Black Berkeys. You can get all of this information on our website, how to do all of this. Save some bottles up, 2-liter soda bottles, for example. Make great water storage containers or those heavy-duty milk bottles. And get some water and things in. Be able to take care of your very basic needs because we might find out next week, the week after, we have our first cases here in the United States. If not in that short a period of time, they are still predicting that the worst dangerous part for us is going to be anywhere from January through March.
All right.
Here in the United States.
Well, we're out of time. Good night.
All right.
God bless you.
Bye-bye. God bless you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Jerry keeps us abreast of what's going on, and certainly this is decimating the bird flocks throughout the world. Hundreds of millions of birds have either died or have actually been killed, you know, to try to stop the spread of this. And I just hope and pray that it doesn't get, you know, to the point where it's readily transmitted from person to person. But you need to be prepared under any circumstances. Fortunately, we know that many of our listeners are making preparations. We think it's a good idea. We certainly advise you to do it. And if you need lists, why, certainly, Jerry, you can go to her website. That's thearkinstitute.com. And she has lists of all the various things that you need to have on hand. And just hope and pray you never need them. Our telephone number, if you'd like to get in touch with my ministry, is 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get certainly information on the spiritual forces that are guiding what's going on in the world today. And there really are spiritual forces out there. You need to get our articles on the occult hierarchy that rules the world. That's the May and June Radio Liberty letters. You'll find them at 1-800. Pardon me, you'll find them on my website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. If you would like to get a free copy of either The Occult Hierarchy Part 2 or A Peak Oil Part 2, we'll be glad to send you one of them if you haven't been in touch with our ministry before. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Why is the peak oil important? Well, because your utilities bill is going to go up, your electric bill, your natural gas bill, your heating costs, and it's all a scam. But it's not going to do you any good, because, of course, it will take us years to undo all the harm has been done by the environmental movement that's been financed, at least in part, by the oil industry. Why would they finance environmental movement? I thought the oil companies wanted to drill for oil. Yes, but they don't want anybody else drilling for oil. And that's how you control your competition. That's what the scam is all about. You need to get our articles, Peak Oil 2. You, of course, need to get our other information, four-tape set, call the oil deception. There's so much material. Why don't you go to our website of radioliberty.com? You can listen to our, certainly to our programs there on the Internet, 5 hours a day. Now, if you are in the Midwest listening on the Here's Help Radio Network, remember we do have a program every Saturday at noon. That's every Saturday at noon. And your assignment is to tell other people about our programs, to get them listening, to realize you're going to hear information here you'll never hear elsewhere about the spiritual battle that is being waged today for the hearts of men and the survival of Western civilization. So, if you'd like, of course, to get in touch with my ministry, get a free newsletter, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our website, radioliberty.com. You can pull down all of our newsletters free there. You can listen to our radio programs and, of course, look at all the other material our ministry offers. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and for our ministers. But please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, because we are on the front lines of this battle. And so until... Well, I guess it'll be Monday now, and we'll be back with you. And Dr. Stan, goodbye. And may the Lord be with you.